This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
This is the BBC.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. We're in a room and we get briefed. So if you really want to know what's going on in the world, then do listen to this podcast. And please let us know what you think by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. If you're minded to do so, please recommend us to your friends or even to your enemies. This week we'll be talking about China. But Catalonia is back in the news, and if you haven't already, you might find our podcast on that a useful primer on why independence is such a problem. The Chinese nation now stands tall and firm in the East. So said the country's president, Xi Jinping, this week. On Wednesday, the Chinese Communist Party started its Congress, held every 5 years. After a week of meetings, a new generation of political leaders will be unveiled. Most will be ardent supporters of President Xi, who is about to be accorded the unusual honour of being allowed to announce his own doctrine, Xi Jinping thought. Where will that thought take him and his huge, strategically essential country? And how might this affect the rest of the world? Step into the briefing room to find out. First into the briefing room, I've invited The Economist's China editor, James Miles, to explain who exactly Xi Jinping is and how he got to be so powerful.
Xi Jinping is an extremely powerful leader, and I think it's fair to say that he's the most powerful leader we've had in China since the days of Mao Zedong. Xi Jinping has rewritten the rules of Chinese politics, and now we see Xi Jinping controlling absolutely everything. He comes from a family that was closely associated with Mao Zedong when he came to power in 1949. His father served as a deputy prime minister during the days of Chairman Mao, and under Deng Xiaoping was the party chief of the southern province of Guangdong. So that pedigree has been an enormous help to Xi Jinping. It means he knows all the powerful families of China. And we mustn't forget that even though China is ruled by a communist party, it is still essentially run by dozens of revolutionary families, people with connections to those who helped Mao come to power in 1949. In order to maintain this level of authority and control in the party, Xi Jinping has had to be utterly ruthless. He took over the party at a time when its politics was beginning to change. Society was changing hugely. A middle class had just begun to evolve in the few years before he took over, rapidly expanding from virtually non-existent in the 1990s to something on the scale perhaps of 100 or 200 million people. So party leaders were beginning to sense that ordinary people, including crucially these members of the middle class, wanted something different. They wanted security. They wanted to know that the wealth they had accumulated would be guaranteed not only for themselves but for their offspring. So Xi Jinping waged a struggle against corruption, and he used his anti-corruption campaign to purge the party of enemies of his. So he came in feeling insecure and feeling that he had to wage a vicious struggle to stay in power. And that explains much of what we've seen over the past 5 years, a ruthless clampdown within the party and on society in general. Apart from waging war on corruption, which has helped to boost his popularity, Xi Jinping has also been actively promoting a kind of mini personality cult. We see Xi Jinping presented on the official media almost as a kind of Mao-like figure. There was a sense when Xi Jinping took over that he might emerge as something of a reformer, but he clearly believed or decided very quickly that only by utterly cracking down on signs of dissent in society would he be able ultimately to achieve anything. And the reason he reached this conclusion was that he was terrified of what had happened in the Soviet Union. Very shortly after he took over, he is reported to have given a speech that said that Mikhail Gorbachev, the last Soviet leader, had failed to be man enough in standing up to opposition within the Soviet Communist Party, and that China needed somebody who was man enough to crush dissent effectively. And there is every reason to expect that over the next 5 years, or for however long he stays in power, he will continue ruling with the same iron rod.
James Miles from The Economist. That's how he got there and how he stayed there. What I want to know now is, what does he actually want to achieve while he's in power at home and abroad, and what that will mean for the rest of the world? In a moment, I'll speak to the former Prime Minister of Australia, Kevin Rudd, and to Lord O'Neill, a former UK Treasury Minister and Chairman of Goldman Sachs. In 2001, he coined the term BRIC to refer to the emerging markets of Brazil, Russia, India and China. But first, I'm joined in the briefing room by the Chinese analyst Yanmei Xia, who's in Beijing.
China does not see itself as pure student who's out to learn, you know, mainly from Western countries. China now feels it's in a position to export its way of governance. It's in a position to export its economic development model, its governance model, and perhaps ideology. And it doesn't feel as much need to learn from the Western countries anymore. Xi Jinping also said he sees himself as a leader who's taking China from a rich country to a strong nation. He sees that his predecessors took China from a big country to a rich country. Now he's bringing China to become a strong country who is about to assert its influence in the global stage. It's no more the hide and bite era of the Deng Xiaoping time. You know, China is about to spread its wings. So that means China feels superiority. It feels that it has weathered all the crises, you know, political, financial, economic, and Western countries have not. And therefore, it feels a sense of superiority and confidence of this recipe of one-party control, some blend of market economy with the state planning as well. It feels that has a perfect recipe that it can export and influence the rest of the world.
That picture sounds fairly, put like that, fairly rosy. What are the problems?
Another thing that happened during his speech, he redefined the principal contradiction of the Chinese society. So put it into historical context, the party always has a principal contradiction to fight against. During the Mao Zedong time, the contradiction changed several times and led the party to struggle, you know, to fight against imperialists, feudalists, nationalists, and capitalists. And in 1959, the party defined the contradiction as one between the people's desire for an advanced industrial country versus the reality that China was a backward agricultural society. And that led to the Great Leap Forward, to force China to leap from an agricultural society to an advanced industrial country. And it took 1981 for Deng Xiaoping to redefine the contradiction again, and it became one between people's demand for material and cultural needs and the backward production forces. And since then, it has never changed until now. And during that period, you know, more than 30 years, approaching 40 now, the party has kept a laser focus on economic development. So now, Xi Jinping's contradiction is people's demand for a better life versus a unbalanced and inadequate economic development. What he meant is that people don't just demand material growth. They also want fairness, you know, justice, better environment, and social welfare. Yet the economy has not provided all of that. So what we're going to see is a de-emphasis on GDP growth. And then the party will be nudged to invest more energy into providing this political and social needs.
Ian Meixia. I'm joined now from Oxford by the former Prime Minister of Australia, Kevin Rudd. He's now president of the Asia Society Policy Institute.
Well, I first met Xi Jinping when he visited Australia. I was Prime Minister at the time, and he came round to the Australian official residence in the nation's capital called the Lodge. It was winter, it was cold, and we actually had a fireside chat for several hours. So that's my first encounter with him rather than the Great Hall of the People. What is he like? He was the first Chinese leader or senior political figure I'd ever met who, in their engagements with foreigners, did not use notes. He had everything at his fingertips. He was prepared not just to adhere to the technical script of whatever the then state of Australia-China relations was, but to range very broadly. So I found him on that score a person extraordinarily well-read in his own history and reasonably well-read in international history.
That paints a picture of a man who's very confident.
This was a person who was entirely self-assured. His self-assurance came from his own political experience as part of a family who'd gone through all the vicissitudes of Chinese politics. His father, Xi Zhongxun's career had mirrored Deng Xiaoping's. It had gone up and down and, together with his father, found himself in difficulty during the Cultural Revolution. So his self-assurance on that score, I think, came from knowing how to navigate the hazardous internal shoals of Chinese politics. He's a person with a deep sense of personal historical mission, aware where China has been strong in its historical past, aware where it's been weak, and the well-hewn narrative of China's century of national humiliation since you Brits landed there to try and force opium down their throats, to the present. So I think within that frame, he has a sense that he's deeply associated with China's return to international greatness.
Did you get an impression of how he had gone about amassing, if you like, that kind of perspective, given that there isn't that kind of freedom of historical discussion in China, or there wasn't certainly when he was growing up?
For the elites within the Chinese Communist Party, there was reasonable access to what you wanted to read. So I think his reading was relatively unconstrained, but it was also in the tradition, I think, of Confucian scholar officials and the traditions of Chinese emperors, where there is, frankly, just a deep assumption that to embark upon any future mission for China, you have to be relatively familiar with the Chinese canon, good emperors and bad emperors, and therefore those who allowed the empire to remain united and strong, as opposed to those who allowed it to fall apart.
Now, we heard earlier in the programme how Xi has cemented his grip on the party and the country over the last 5 years. He's purged opponents from the party and he's cracked down on dissent. In your view, is this a matter for concern for us in the West?
I think it's the nature of the Chinese Communist Party beast. I've often am puzzled by Westerners who conclude that as a political construct, the Chinese Communist Party is in a permanent state of evolution out of communism, out of Leninism, and into something approaching a Chinese form of democracy and ultimately some sort of liberal Western democracy. That's just not their self-conceptualization. It wasn't Deng's, it's not this guy's as well.
In the past, Chinese communism was something to aspire to. Well, he's obviously not a Chinese communist in that sense, so what does he aspire to?
I think he aspires to two things. They're captured in two words, Fuqiang, and they are basically national prosperity and power. This new evidence of Xi Jinping theory, which adds to Deng Xiaoping's formula in one, albeit opaque way. Deng Xiaoping said that under him we would now have socialism with Chinese characteristics, which basically means whatever the Chinese tradition interpreted by a Leninist elite believes should be added in order to make China wealthy and powerful, then we're going to do that. And the new flexibility which Xi Jinping has afforded himself is to talk about a new period of socialism with Chinese characteristics.
Well, let's talk a bit about that power point. What does Xi want from Chinese power? What would he mean by it?
Where Xi Jinping, I think, has been domestically skillful as a political leader has been that rather than this being a purely statist concept about the future, he also very early in his period in office, 5 years ago, outlined his concept of the China Dream, Zhongguo Meng. His vision for China's future was not just about national wealth and national power. It was all about your individual prosperity as well as your ability to pursue your own futures. Chinese power will be focused on maintaining and regaining, as it were, the unity of the motherland, and that goes to the whole question of Taiwan and suppressing dissent in either Xinjiang or Tibet. It's about maintaining benign relationships with the 14 countries which share land borders with China and bringing about a set of foreign policies and policy settings in those neighbouring states which are accommodating of Chinese interests. And then you begin to push out further into, over time, supplanting the United States as the principal strategic power in East Asia and the West Pacific. And then there's the final part of the debate, which we're just beginning, which is how does China articulate its future role in global institutions?
If Xi succeeds in his own terms, where do you think he and China will be in 10 years' time?
When Xi Jinping became leader back in 1213, the party released a new economic reform document called The Decision. It's basically the blueprint for how you move China to the next economic model with greater emphasis on the efficiency of resource allocation, less role for state-owned enterprises, more role for private firms, a more open trading system or open investment system. The problem is, over the last 5 years, it's made very slow progress. So here's the question. Whether post the 19th Party Congress, Xi Jinping grasps this reform blueprint and then puts his political weight entirely behind its implementation, or will there be a set of untidy compromises of 1.5 steps forward, 1 step back, as he's more weighed down by the immediacy of sustaining growth and employment levels and keeping the housing market bubbling along?
Do you think there will be, as a consequence of progress to the reforms that you're talking about, any progress on what we call human rights in China?
In political free speech and the associated freedoms underpinned by an independent legal system, the answer is no. If you mean the other relevant UN covenant on economic and social rights and the expansion of Chinese prosperity to those who are still in poverty, about 80 million Chinese, I think the answer will be yes. But if you're waiting for an Eleanor Roosevelt moment where finally the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights is realised in Chinese practice, don't hold your breath.
Kevin Rudd. Finally, looking ahead for us, I hope, is the economist Jim O'Neill, who's here in the briefing room in London. Jim O'Neill, we've heard how Xi Jinping has wiped out the rival factions and become hugely powerful. What do you think he wants to do with that power over the next 5 years?
Well, my honest answer is I have no idea. I've never had that discussion with him. And in fact, I say it like that deliberately because I'm sometimes quite sceptical about people that pertain to be experts about what's going on with the ins and outs of the top Chinese leadership. What he has to do is to continue to preside over real evidence that 1.3 billion Chinese people are seeing their lives improve in terms of wealth and prosperity.
Obviously, we all know that China's economic growth is important to us, but just how important is it?
Well, there's so many ways I could try to highlight it. Let me try and crystallise it on some numbers I've just put together for something I did earlier this week. We all talk, particularly people from the finance world, about all the challenges of China and China's slowing growth, which indeed it has done this decade. This year it will probably show growth somewhere 6.7 per year. But of course, that's coming on top of a base of an economy that's $11 trillion. So translated into some kind of global context, that's going to be an additional $1 trillion of US nominal GDP this year, which is equivalent to creating any one of the economies around the world beyond the top 15.
So it's like,
it's like creating another Australia or half the United Kingdom in 1 year. Put it in slightly further context, since 2010, this period where China has slowed, Chinese GDP has doubled from 6 to 12 trillion. People often bemoan the supposed paucity of the role of the Chinese consumer, but it is rising slowly. The official data shows it's gone to 39.2% of overall GDP from 35.5% at the start of the decade. Again, translated into basic numbers, that's an increase of $2.5 trillion. So their consumer, which supposedly doesn't play a big role, in the last 6 years has increased in value by the same as the size of India. Now, so it's huge.
Now, we hear a lot of talk about Chinese investment in the rest of the world, China's building projects, its great big initiatives in the rest of the world. What is more important to us, Chinese consumers, the growth of Chinese consumption, or their work in the rest of the world and their investments in the rest of the world? How do we see those?
I think it's a very important thing for people to focus on. Anything to do with the economic context of China, very quickly a lot of Western people lose their objectivity. And it is quite revealing in my view, because it basically defaults to, I don't believe it, there are a bunch of commies, it can't be true. At its most basic, because of the connection of everybody's different economies, what we should be really focused on is what China is doing in terms of its own domestic activities and what it might therefore do in terms of its trade and opportunities for the rest of the world. And that's why I highlight, albeit modest, the rising share of Chinese consumption. For us in the UK, almost definitely, indirectly, that is the most important thing, because that ultimately, particularly in this weird post-Brexit world, in terms of us trying to sell more to other places, that is what's really important. To touch back again to the size of China, the additional $1 trillion they will create this year is the same as 5 new New Zealands. How many times has the UK's trade secretary actually been to China? I'm guessing either none or not much, where he seems to be banging on about New Zealand every other month. Doesn't make a lot of sense to me. The Chinese consumer is easily the most important thing in the world economy, and any country or any international business that's trying to sell something to other parts of the world.
So we can't know, of course, but if we were to try and guess what is keeping Mr. Xi awake at night, what he worries about, you seem to be suggesting what he'd be worrying about is whether he can give the Chinese consumer what the Chinese consumer has come to expect.
I think at the end of the day, that is what he will constantly think about, because it seems to me one of the reasons why so many of China's 1.3 billion people don't worry about the absence of democracy in the way which so many foreign observers say they should do, is because many of them feel this remarkable rising prosperity. Very odd anecdote in this regard. Towards the end of August, I took a very nice few days walking in the beautiful Swiss Alps around the Germanic part near the Jungfrau. And it's the first time I'd been around there in 30-odd years. And I remember in those days that the sort of cute but very expensive train that would go up to the top of the Jungfrau, the last carriage was dominated by the Japanese, because they were the only people that had the wealth to do it. Guess who dominates it these days? And more importantly for me, in the Alpine villages around that area, tens and tens of very young Chinese people. And that's the sort of thing that Switzerland is benefiting from. For us, and anybody else, you know, what is it we've got that they're interested in buying more of?
You were talking earlier about the size of the Chinese economy and so on. It's still significantly smaller than the United States economy.
About 12 trillion, which is what it'll be at the end of this year, it makes it about, what, two-thirds the size of the US.
So there's not going to be a kind of passing by America anytime soon.
I always think of it because of the thing which made me so well-known in this part of the world and these issues, the so-called BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India and China. We suggested it would be 2027 when China would become as big as the US. I've occasionally joked that I wake up with cold sweats at night getting to 2028 and the Chinese leadership come and drag me out of my bed and said, you said by 2027 we would be as big as the US and we're not. But they're on track for being there thereabouts, but it's not going to happen before the end of this decade, that's for sure.
Where does that leave Britain? I mean, it leaves Britain facing the Chinese consumer and trying to appeal to the Chinese consumer. Put in the most kind of blunt terms, is there a lot of money for us in China?
Yeah, let me be as blunt as possible. We need something like Burberry, which is one of the few companies that really excels at selling to the Chinese what they want, to be as big as an Apple. America's arguably most iconic company of modern times, about 3 years ago, started to go through a number of quarters where it sold more iPhones to Chinese consumers than it did in the US. What more would you want? One of the most interesting economic statistics I've seen so far this year related to data to do with German trade at the end of last year, where combining both imports and exports, and this is relevant in the emotion of the EU debate, Germany now has seen its number one trade partner become China. It's overtaken each of the US and France to be Germany's number one trade partner. Just in the past week, I've seen something from one firm revising up their forecast for German growth purely because of the influence of China in terms of trade for Germany.
So what have we got to do?
We've got to take it a lot more seriously than we do. You know, being good at trade means you've got to be really good at trade. All this stuff about being in the EU or not being in the EU, as Germany demonstrates, on one level is a bit of a red herring. So we have to treat it seriously. Having been somebody that was in the middle of developing this so-called golden relationship with the Chinese, something that I'm very proud of, since we had the enforced change in leadership of the government 18 months ago, the golden relationship feels a little bit less golden. Because I don't think our leadership is taking it seriously. I said before, just this year, China will effectively create another five New Zealands. How many times do the few ministerial figures involved in trying to advocate Britain post-EU even talk about China? They talk about New Zealand frequently. It's a beautiful place, but it's not going to change the dial for the future of the UK. Trade with China could. On investment here in the UK, I also know in great detail one of my other big passions in life, the so-called Northern Powerhouse. The Chinese love the concept of the Northern Powerhouse because in China, in the past decade, they've rather successfully attempted to shift the drivers of economic growth geographically around the country. So they understand that idea and are very positively inclined towards trying to get involved if they were allowed to.
Jim O'Neill. Time for a breathless summing up. China is at a new stage in its sense of self-confidence. We shouldn't hold our breaths on any political liberalisation. And the continuing rise of the Chinese consumer will offer opportunities to those that can take them. But Britain, at the moment, is not at the races. My thanks to James Miles, Yan-Mei Shia, Kevin Rudd and Lord O'Neill. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by, and I'm serious here, China Collins. Please let us know what you think about this programme or the entire series. You can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. We look forward to reading your comments.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Paris. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.